Welcome back. The rest of this afternoon, I would like to continue where I left off, was describing some of the problems, some of the facts that the discoveries were made, almost all the discoveries that we know of today were made by Bible-believing Christians. And I mentioned all the different scientific discoveries, the Bible-believing scientists of the past who formed almost every scientific discipline from oceanography to paleontology to stratigraphy to thermodynamics and thermokinetics, vertebrate paleontology, all of these subjects were made by young Earth creationists. And all of the fields of the discoveries were also made by Bible-believing scientists. And so knowing that, we look at the originators of evolutionary theory. Most of them were not scientists themselves. They were simply lawyers or people who became in positions of administration, but not actually actual scientists. But they became the ones who took over and became the promoters of evolutionary theory. Now, to skip over some of them and just look at what is the evidence for creation itself as opposed to evolution, we look at the DNA to code 124 proteins. What is the possibility of this happening by chance? If both sufficient DNA to code 124 proteins and sufficient protein 124 to house and catalyze DNA independently evolved and subsequently associated together to form the first living entity, their individual probabilities must be multiplied. The total probability would be 1 over 10 to the 89,132nd power, that's the probability of forming DNA, times 1 over 10 to the 78,436th power, that's the probability of forming 124 proteins, which is 1 over 10 to the 167,568th power, assuming 1 million Earths around every star in the universe, each having all of its oceans full of nucleotides linking to form DNAs every second for 10 billion years. Now, that's the summary of an entire book that goes through and details that probability. You could only cram 130th power electrons in the known universe. So you can see the evolutionary scenario has a serious problem. And the thing is, these 124 proteins of 400 amino acids each is theoretically the smallest organism, but in reality, even a simple bacterium, Escherichia coli, the common intestinal inhabitant of man and animal, contains 3 million DNA base pairs. Thus, it can manufacture 2,500 proteins. That's 20 times the number of proteins that I just mentioned, of 400 amino acids each. David Cooperidge, in his book on probabilities, argues that the time necessary to form one protein is commensurate with the time necessary for an amoeba crawling at the breathtaking speed of 1 inch per year to move the entire mass of 10 to the 64th galaxies the size of ours, one atom at a time, across a string stretched the 30 billion light year diameter of the known universe. It's estimated that the amount of DNA necessary to code 100 billion people could be contained in half an aspirin tablet. But despite the virtual impossibility of proteins arising by chance, there's not the remotest reason to believe that they could ever form a membrane-encased, self-reproducing, self-repairing, metabolizing living cell. That's a jump in complexity that nobody's even able to guess at how that could happen. There's no evidence that any stable state exists between the assumed naturalistic formation of protein and the formation of the first living cell. And when you look at a single living cell, you can see how complex it really is. And this is what caused Michael Behe, who is not a creationist at all, but when he saw the complexity of the cell, he realized that this naturalistic evolution is not going to work. So he wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box, and in it he disproves the possibility of evolution happening by chance. Well, we look at several people like Austin Clark. He was one of the early scientists, and He said, are we, and Austin Clark, he was an ardent evolutionist on the staff of the Smithsonian Institute from 1908 to 1950 and a member of several important scientific organizations. He was a prominent scientist. He authored over several books and over 600 scientific articles, but after years of honestly trying to deal with the fact that there's no evidence of cross-species change, in 1930, he wrote an astounding book called The New Evolution, Zoogenesis. In it, he cited fact after fact, disproving the possibility that major types of plants and animals could have evolved from one another. The evolutionary world was stunned into silence, for he was the expert who knew all the reasons why trans-species evolution was impossible. His alternative proposal, zoogenesis, was that every major type of plant and animal must have evolved, not from one another, but directly from dirt and water. Sounds like creation. It was Richard Goldschmidt that same year that Clark wrote his book that Goldschmidt gave up also. As an earnest evolutionist, he had dedicated his life to proving that by applying X-rays and chemicals to fruit flies in the University of California, Berkeley, and producing large numbers of mutations in them, that he could somehow cause one to evolve into another. And after 25 exhausting years in which he had worked with more generations of fruit flies than humans, and their ape ancestors are conjectured to have lived on this planet, Goldschmidt decided that it must figure out a different way that cross-species evolution could occur. In other words, he'd bombard these fruit flies with rays and chemicals and various other things, and he could split a gene so he could get four wings instead of, or six wings in some cases, but the wings had no muscles attached to them. So you could split a gene, but you couldn't create new information. And that's what he found, that as specificity increases, the role played by spontaneity decreases. The more complex a system is, the less likely a random process is going to increase that complexity. And we find that fossils provide the only evidence that evolution has occurred on this planet. So a guy named Colin Patterson, who had the largest fossil collection in the world, wrote a book called Evolution. And in it, he didn't include any transitional forms. And so Luther Sunderland read the book and wrote back and said to Colin Patterson, he said, I noticed you didn't include any transitional forms in your book on fossils. And Colin Patterson wrote back and said, I would have loved to have included some transitional forms if I'd have had any, but I don't even know how to tell an artist how to draw one because I don't know what one would look like. And so here we have, if transitional forms are the only evidence that evolution has occurred on this planet, we don't see any transitional forms, then what are we going to do? Well, basically, that's what Goldschmidt did. He came up with a hopeful monster mechanism, which said one animal jumped from one kind to another kind without leaving any transitional forms. So the reason we don't see evolution in the present world is because evolution goes too slow. It takes millions of years to see that happen. The reason we don't see evolution in the fossil record is because evolution goes in spurts. It goes in fast. It jumps from one kind to another kind without leaving any transitional forms. Well, how is this going to happen? Well, as Ernest Meyer said, mutations provide the only evidence that evolution has occurred on this planet. Mutations provide the only mechanism that would cause evolution to occur. Because how else are you going to change it, change something? So mutations, either chemical or radioactive bombarding, it's like shooting a bullet at a chromosome and destroying some of the genes. It's not adding any new teleonomy or specific information to the genetic code. It's simply jumbling up or destroying some of the information that's there, and as specificity increases, the role played by spontaneity decreases. The more complex the system is, the less likely a random process is going to increase that complexity. It's like throwing my computer on the floor and expecting to add two more programs. It's not likely to happen because random processes never add information. They only destroy the information that's there. And so we're justified in saying that evolution on a vertical scale is absolutely impossible according to laws of science that we know today. Now, we look at the timeline of when these things are supposed to have happened. And I have a picture here, a chart, which shows Adam, and it shows how long he lived, and then it goes to the next. And interesting to know that 1,656 years after the time of Adam's creation, we have the flood. And after the flood, we have only interestingly enough, 104 years until the time of the Tower of Babel, where God confounded the languages and they split up and went out throughout the earth. That seems like a short time, but that's what everybody agrees with. It's 104 years, that difference between the time they got off the ark and the time that they actually split and dispersed throughout the world. And then you have a thing about catastrophic plate tectonics. This was something that John Baumgartner had done. John Baumgartner had done this as a project to get his doctorate, and basically he had to go to Japan to find computers big enough to basically run his model. But he was showing how the actual continents moved into place during the time of the flood. So you have this, what we see is basically a picture of the flood. And during the flood, at the time of the flood, we have the ice age occurring from the time of the flood on. And so from that ice age, during that time of the ice age, we have people spreading out throughout the world, and many of them coming from Mongolia, and they were coming over to America by going over the strait, the Bering Strait up there by Alaska. And eventually, maybe that was covered with ice and snow, and they could have walked across. It's quite possible during the ice age. That would have probably been true. And then they could have gotten on a sled. And one person said, he got on his, made a shift, makeshift sled and a team of dogs and ended up in Brazil and decided if he was ever going to do this again, he definitely would install brakes. Well, anyway, the people actually ended up going south, partially because half the United States was covered with ice. And so they basically migrated to Mesoamerica, Latin America, and South America. And that's where we have the Aztecs, the Mayans, the different groups. And so we see that basically happening throughout the world. Then we have a group, a guy, the Adam and the Genome, trying to show how this possibly came about. But here's a guy that comes up with there being 10,000 Adams and 10,000 Eves. And that's a progressive creationist idea. The progressive creationism sees that the water was at least 22 feet above the highest mountaintops. Well, what is going to hold the water in? There is nothing that could do that. It's ridiculous. A local flood is basically not something that fits the biblical description of Genesis. In fact, there was necessary because a worldwide cataclysm deluge would have completely revoked, reworked, and redeposited all the geologic data which was supposedly formed during the vast ages that evolution is supposed to have taken place. The flood and the global catastrophism had to be destroyed before the idea of vast ages in organic and human evolution could be established. So the progressive creationist is taking the evolutionary concept of billions of years, the Earth being 4.6 billion years old, the universe being 13.7 billion years old or thereabouts. But that long age is not really necessary because God says that he created the stars on the fourth day. So the Earth was created first, according to the biblical picture. And we see all kinds of fallacies concerning the age of the Earth, the permanence of the created kinds in Genesis. The New Testament accepts historicity of Genesis and the creation and the flood accounts. Jesus talked about Adam and Eve, about Cain and Abel, about Noah and flood. And Noah and the flood, he said, if it were not so, I would have told you. So all these events actually did occur, according to Jesus, according to the New Testament as well. There's no contextual basis for a gap between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. That's basically the theory behind the gap theory. And no clear reference to a biblical pre-Adamite race, which some people teach. There's no evidence for evolutionary ages, no purpose behind in creation, why dinosaurs, for example, evolution and the eternal pre-worlds characteristic is characteristic of the pagan religions and philosophies, but not a biblical Christianity. Evolutionists admit that the Big Bang would only have produced hydrogen and helium. However, nuclear gaps at 5 and 8 make it impossible for hydrogen and helium to actually produce into any heavier elements. So we have that problem as well. So anyway, I look at progressive creationism as simply a way of trying to use evolution model and then saying that there's a God behind the process, but we don't need to do that because the Bible is very clear that the earth was created in 6 literal days. Now, there's an interesting thing about there's an interesting fellow I met at the last International Creation Conference, a guy named Nathaniel Jason. He wrote a book called Replacing Darwin. And in the book, he shows that there was actually no need. The author shows the rate of human mutation actually corresponds to a creationist time scale of 6,000 years. The genetic load, based upon what we know today, and the woman would be 6,000 years ago, she would have had her first child. And that fits in right well with the biblical model as well. And as the evolutionist has to look at each one of the organs and figure out how this could happen naturally, and he looks at the human eye and he sees that we have 10 million photoreceptor cells. Each one has the capacity to perform the equivalent of 500 nonlinear simultaneous differential equations 100 times a millisecond. So when you consider there's 10 million of them interacting with each other in complex ways, it would take a Cray supercomputer over 100 years to simulate what takes place in the back of your eye many times every second. And then we have all of the muscles in the eye. We have the iris to get short, to get smaller during when it's bright out and get larger to collect more light in darkness. We have the lens, which basically changes its shape so it can focus on whatever we need to focus on. And then we've got the muscles surrounding the eye. Some of them turn it like a doorknob. Others actually go up and down and side to side. And both of those eyes, muscle systems coordinate exactly to the other eye so that both eyes are focusing on the same thing at the same time. And if they're not doing that, that's an eye disease. And it's very uncomfortable because you don't see clearly. Then we look at the ear itself. The ear has a eardrum, which is sensitive to 1/10 the diameter of a hydrogen atom. It can measure that and send that signal to the hammer, anvil, and stirrup, which goes up against another membrane attached to the cochlea, which has 3 chambers. And in the inner chamber, called the cochlea duct, has the organ of Corti and the tectoral membrane. And between those two are thousands of tiny hair cells. Each one has a spring cell with a trapdoor attached to it that opens and closes up to 20,000 times a second to let a single charged sodium ion, which we interpret as sound. Living technology itself is amazingly complex. We look at just about everything, and most complex phenomena known to science are found in living systems. Examples of these designs include the molecular size motors in most living systems, advanced technologies in cells, miniature and reliable sonar systems of dolphins, porpoises, and whales, frequency modulated radar and discrimination systems of bats. Richard Dawkins wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker, and in the book he was commenting on the tremendous complexity of the bat's discrimination system, how it can actually hear and adjust its flight to avoid obstacles. And he says, isn't evolution wonderful? I thought that was interesting. Then we have the efficient aerodynamic capabilities of hummingbirds, the control systems, internal ballistics, and combustion chamber of the bombardier beetles, precise and redundant navigational systems of many birds, fish, and insects, and especially the self-repair capabilities of almost all forms of life. No component of these complex systems could have evolved without placing the organism in a selective disadvantage until the component's evolution was complete. All evidence points to intelligent design. And as I mentioned before, mutations provide the last hope. According to Ernest Mayr, the process of mutation is the only known source of new materials of genetic variability and hence of evolution. Dobzhansky in his American Science wrote that. He says it remains true to say that we know of no other random mutation by which new hereditary variation comes into being, nor any process other than natural selection by which the hereditary constitution of population changes from one generation to the next. So if mutations are the only mechanism that would cause evolution to occur, and they don't include, and they can't make it more complex, then how could evolution occur at all? And we have the second law of thermodynamics. Everything goes from simple to complex. This is extreme improbability of mutations providing information required for evolution to move forward in a direct direction of increasing complexity is supposed to be balanced by the extreme amount of time. The problem is time's arrow goes the wrong direction, because everywhere in observable time and observable space, entropy increases. Entropy is a measure of disorder. This is why our bodies wear out. Our cars wear out. Everything goes from order to disorder. Given enough time means that everything is going to stop. Given an infinite amount of time, motion would stop altogether. And so the evolutionist doesn't deal with that. The Big Bang theory was supposed to explain something, and modern astrophysics, in fact, physicists, in fact, are currently speculating that the universe itself spontaneously evolved out of nothing. In this picture, the universe came into existence as a fluctuation of the quantum mechanical vacuum. However, this hypothesis, they don't even know what a quantum mechanical vacuum was. We asked the question, our universe was simply one of those things that happens from time to time. A tiny bit of nothing packed so tightly together that it blew up and produced all the matter in the universe. First of all, nothingness can't pack together. It would have no way to push itself into a pile. A vacuum has no density. It said that the nothingness got very dense, and that's why it basically, that's why it exploded. But a total vacuum is the opposite of total density. There's no ignition to explode the nothingness. No match, no fire. It could not be a chemical explosion. There were no chemicals. It couldn't be a nuclear explosion. There were no atoms. There's no way to expand. How can you expand what isn't there? Even if the magical vacuum could somehow be pushed together by gravity, what would cause the pile of emptiness to push outward? The gravity which brought it together would keep it from expanding. And nothingness can't produce heat. The intense heat caused by the exploding nothingness is said to change the nothingness into protons, neutrons, and electrons. First, an empty vacuum in this extreme cold of outer space can't get hot by itself. And then second, an empty void can't magically change itself into matter. Third, there can't be any heat without an energy source. And as I mentioned before, the mass 5 and mass 8 gaps, nuclear gaps at mass 8 and mass 5 are making it impossible for hydrogen or helium to change itself into any of the heavier elements. And then we have a problem with the origin of the solar system. This is an interesting one because the seven theories about the origin of the solar system, the nebular hypothesis, the fission theory, the capture theory, the accretion theory, the planetary collision theory, the stellar collision theory, and the glass cloud theory, none of them explain anything. All seven theories require circling gas, which contracts into the sun. That underlying concept has already been disproved, and you've got unique plants. This is a composite photograph showing not to scale, but all the planets in the solar system, except for Pluto there from top to bottom, Mercury, Venus, Earth, with the moon to be to the Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. The photos are taken by Mariner 10, Mercury, Pioneer, Venus. But Saturn has 33 known moons. One of them, named Phoebe, has an orbit almost perpendicular to Saturn's equator. This is difficult for evolutionists to explain. Actually, the rings have nothing to do with the planet's origin. And we can see that none of these theories, the sun was not made out of the same, the Earth's not made out of the same composition as the sun. The moon is not made of the same composition of the Earth. And none of the moons on Saturn are made of the same compositions of each other or of Saturn. So how did the moons get there? And some of the moons, we have one moon chasing the other in the same order, yet they never collide. They're in this same orbit around Saturn. And we see, so none of these theories, the planet collision theory, the stellar collision theory, capture theory, none of them explain how this ordered system could come about by chance. It couldn't. And Johann Kepler He was considered to be the founder of physical astronomy. He built upon a foundation of studies of Copernicus and Tycho Brahe, as well as utilizing a telescope developed by Galileo, but it was he who discovered the laws of planetary motion and who established the discipline of celestial mechanics. He demonstrated the heliocentricity of the solar system, and they published the first tables for tracking the star motions, contributed to eventual development of calculus. You wonder how he was able to do this with the limited equipment that he had, but Kepler studied for 2 years in seminary, leaving only reluctantly and to enter the study and teaching of astronomy when the Lord opened the door. He stated he was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. His astronomical studies also led him to study biblical chronology. He believed that the Earth was created about 7,000 years ago. Kepler wrote in one of his books, "Since we astronomers are priests of the highest God, in regard to the book of nature, it befits us to be thoughtful, not of the glory of our minds, but rather, above all, the glory of God." And we have people like Michael Faraday. Michael Faraday is universally acknowledged as one of the greatest physicists of all time. He was especially gifted in scientific experimentation, particularly in developing a new science of electricity and magnetism. He discovered electromagnetic induction and introduced the concept of magnetic lines of force. He invented the generator and made many other discoveries and inventions. Yet this great man was one of the most humble and sincere Christians one could ever find. He had abiding faith in the Bible and in prayer. He fully believed in the official doctrine of his church, which said the Bible and it alone, with nothing added to it or taken away from it by man, is the sole and sufficient guide for each individual at all times and in all circumstances. Faith in the divinity and work of Christ is the gift of God, and the evidence of this faith is in obedience to the commandments of Christ. We have people like Isaac Newton and Joseph Clerk Maxwell. Maxwell was one of the greatest scientists of all time. He was also a sincere Bible-believing Christian, building on the concepts of experimental work with his friend Faraday. He developed a comprehensive theoretical and mathematical framework of electrodynamic field theory, embracing all types of energy systems except gravity and nuclear forces within this famous electromagnetic wave spectrum. Albert Einstein called Maxwell's achievement the most profound and most fruitful of that physics has experienced since the time of Newton. He also extended the field of classical thermodynamics into the broader field of statistical thermodynamics and made many other notable contributions in physics and mathematics. His Christian beliefs were essential fundamentalists in nature. He was strongly opposed to evolution and was able to develop a rigorous mathematical refutation of the famous nebular hypothesis of French atheist Laplace. He also wrote an incisive refutation of the evolutionary philosophies of Herbert Spencer, the great advocate of Darwinism. A prayer found in his handwriting after his death quoted the Genesis account of man's creation in God's image and the command to subdue the earth as a motivation for his scientific studies, while also acknowledging his personal faith in Jesus Christ, his Lord and Savior. And we have Isaac Newton, famous for, among other things, the discovery in the law of universal gravitation, the formation of the three laws of motion, which make possible the discipline of dynamics and all of its subdivisions, and his development of calculus into a comprehensive branch of mathematics, now a basic tool in every science. He anticipated the great law of energy conservation, developed the particle theory of light propagation, and as an astronomer constructed the first reflecting telescope. This great intellect was also a genuine believer in Christ and his Savior, and the Bible is God's word. He wrote many books on biblical subjects, especially prophecy. He was a committed believer from his youth. He even wrote a book defending the Usher chronology against those who would try to push back the date of creation. He wrote strong papers refuting atheism and defending creation and the Bible. He believed that the worldwide flood of the Bible accounted for most of the geologic phenomena. He believed that the literal six-day creation. Finally, he said, "We account the scriptures of God to be the most sublime philosophy. I find more sure marks of the authenticity of the Bible than in any profane history whatsoever." And the communist plan to take over America involved basically destroying history as anti-American. Reading went to the whole word method to make man mostly illiterate. math, connected math, which was destroying man's ability to calculate things. Ethics, value clarification. In other words, there was no universal ethic or laws because there's no God. In biology, they went to evolution, again, denying God. Truth was all relative. The government was globalism versus nationalism. Christianity went to humanism, where man is basically an atheist. Economics was using John Maynard Keynes' idea, which was a form of socialism as opposed to capitalism. And then the psychology was more secular versus biblical. The law was positivism, and that rejected the spiritual. In other words, humanism versus theism. And then sociology was feminism and abortion, along with LGBTQ and all the rest of it. And the philosophy, naturalism, dialectical materialism, and mystical monism, as far as their philosophies are concerned. So that was the communist plan to overtake. Humanism is no match for God. It has to be secular humanism. That's what basically they taught. But Francis Schaeffer, one of the leading Christian philosophers, studied the decline of Western civilization, and he came to the conclusion that secular humanism is responsible for the problems that exist. And that because secular humanists advocate abortion, homosexuality, prisoners' rights, socialism, world government, and deny the existence of God. And so that concludes the second part of my talk, and we will continue on later. Thank you for listening.